You can't take it with you. How many times have you heard that expression? That's one of those expressions where you wish you had a nickel for every time you'd heard it, isn't it? You can't take it with you. You've probably said that a bunch of times. Sometimes we say that in consoling somebody maybe that's had some loss of some personal possessions. Maybe a tornado or a house fire has destroyed much of their earthly possessions. And we say, well, that's all right because you can't take it with you anyway. Sometimes we say that as a lesson or a series of admonitions to someone who is too concerned, we think, about worldly possessions and things. And we say, you need to be realizing that you can't take it with you. But this morning I want to contradict that just a little bit and tell you you can take it with you. Now, there are certainly some things you can't take with you, and we're going to talk about some of those things, but there are some things that you can take with you. In other words, you will not leave this life and appear before God on the judgment day completely empty-handed. There'll be some things that will accompany you. And so let's talk about that day of judgment. Implied in both statements, you can take it with you and you can't take it with you, implied in that statement is that you're going somewhere. If you get nothing else out of our time this morning, I hope you remember this. You're going somewhere. You're headed towards some destination. And we, even Christians, even children of God, need a constant, daily, maybe hourly reminder that we're going somewhere. Don't ever forget that. That you're going somewhere. Don't ever forget that. And don't ever become unaware of where you are going. So many of us are like the airline pilot. Joke is told about the airline pilot that came over the intercom of a commercial flight and said, I've got good news and bad news. The bad news is all of our instruments are down. They're not working. And so we have no idea where we're at and no idea where we're going. But the good news is we're making good time. That's a lot of us spiritually, isn't it? We're making good time, but we have absolutely no idea where we're going. So first, think about the idea that you're going somewhere. Now, before we talk about some things we can take with us, I want to assure you that I haven't completely lost my mind, that I know that there are some things that we can't take with us. There are some things that just simply are not that important because they are temporary. You could make this list as well as I can. Our money and our possessions. That's usually what we talk about, isn't it, when we say you can't take it with you. It's those earthly possessions that we have, including our finances and all of our money, are going to be burned up one day. Turn with me, if you will, in the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 2. The wise man in the book of Ecclesiastes spends much time trying to get us to get our priorities properly ordered. And understand that there is some value, there is some benefit to earthly possessions, to money, but they are not eternally important. Look what he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Look beginning in verse 18. Ecclesiastes 2 verse 18 says, Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. Solomon says, surveying his kingdom, and what a kingdom it must have been. Of all the power, all the wealth, and all the trappings of that kingdom, that he had collected. And now as an old man, he realizes, I'm going to have to leave every bit of this. I can't take it with me. And one of the crying shames, he says, is I'm going to have to leave it to somebody else. Somebody who did not labor for it, who didn't sweat and toil and put the thought into it that I did, and somebody else who's not going to have the wisdom and the care for it that I did. Every cent that you struggle for and fight for, you're going to have to leave behind. Every earthly possession, no matter how trivial or how cherished it might be to you, whether it has monetary or sentimental value to you, you're going to have to leave it behind. That's a constant, and that's one of those things you say, well, I know that. But we need a constant reminder of that. Because we live in a world, we live in a society, and Satan is preying upon what our world and our society is teaching us every day, is that this is what matters. And we're going to be sorely disappointed on Judgment Day that we have spent so much time. Several years ago, we were on vacation and went down to the beach, and they were doing these, I don't know what you call them. You wouldn't call them sandcastles, because what we used to make were sandcastles. They were humongous works of art. So massive, but yet so intricate in their detail, made out of sand. There would be a whole castle and a dragon and some maiden hanging out. It was just amazing what some artist could do with just grains of sand. And what was interesting to me was, there were two things interesting. Number one is that somebody had that much artistic ability. I'm like my dad, the only thing I can draw is flies. I have no artistic ability, but if somebody could take sand and make something that big and that beautiful and that detailed. But also what struck me was, it was made out of sand on the beach. That he had put hours upon hours, and I don't remember the time, but they told how many hours were put in, how many man hours were put into collecting the sand and shaping it and forming it. And it was only going to last for a day or two. Because the next time the high tide came in, it was going to wash it all away. That'll be our reality on Judgment Day, won't it? That all of these things we've done, that they're just going to be washed away with the sands of time. There's some other things you can't take with you, your earthly accomplishments. It doesn't matter what you do in this life. Of a carnal nature, of an earthly nature. Are you still in the book of Ecclesiastes? Turn back to chapter 1. And in verse 11, where it says, there is no reminder of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. All your children remember you. Your grandchildren. But that's when the memory starts to fade, isn't it? How many of us here today, without any kind of prompting, without any kind of research, could name your maternal great-great-grandmother? That's not that many generations back, and that's somebody that's related to you. And you don't know what their name is unless you looked it up. Just a few years ago, we lived in Joplin, Missouri, and right beside the church building there in Joplin was Missouri Southern State University, and they were having a big to-do because they were renaming a building. Somebody had given an endowment of millions of dollars, and so they were getting their name put on a building. It was going to be named Plaster Hall. And I can remember joking that they were going to have their name plastered on that wall there because they'd given millions of dollars. But what I found interesting is not that here was somebody who had enough money, enough power, enough prestige that their name was going to be stuck on a building. That they may not know generations to come, they may not know who that person is, but they're going to know that somebody by the name of Plaster gave a lot of money, and so we put his name on this building. But what was interesting about that, in order to name that building, they had to scrape off the name Matthews. That used to be Matthews Hall. And I don't know, but I imagine years ago, somebody else with a bunch of money gave money to the college, and they put his name on that building. But I figured they probably spent all that money. He had died, and enough of his immediate family had died that they thought, we don't care about Matthews anymore, so we scraped his name off the building and put somebody else's name on the building. That's going to happen to you and I. Not too long after you're dead, they're going to scrape your name off the mailbox, and they're going to put somebody else's name there. And they're going to forget about you. Whatever you've done in this life, whatever accomplishments you've made, are going to mean nothing because you can't take it with you. You know, I fear that sometimes we're working hard on the wrong assignment. Let me illustrate it this way. I grew up in rural Coleman County, just south of here, and went to school at West Point. I tell people all over the country I graduated from West Point. It sounds prestigious, doesn't it? But it was just West Point High School, and I was a average student at best. I was a little lazy, and I can remember one time where it was going to be close. I needed to make real good grades on an assignment in order to be able to pass a class, and so I worked hard. I worked harder than I ever had on this assignment because I needed to do real good on this assignment to pull my grade up so I could coast the rest of the semester, and so I worked hard on that assignment. I can remember I not only worked hard on it, but I rewrote it so that it would look neat in its appearance. And I made my mom go to the store and buy a new little folder to put it in so it looked attractive, maybe impress the teacher and get a couple little bonus points there. And I turned that assignment in. And the next day, when she graded those assignments and returned us to us, she called me up to her desk. And I thought, this is either good or bad. It was usually bad in my case. But she called me up to the desk and she said, you did a great job on this assignment. You got all of the questions right. You would be given extra points for penmanship and neatness and presentation. But you did the wrong assignment. It's the story of my life. Will that be you on Judgment Day? Will God say, man, you worked hard. You get extra points. You had a nice, fine house, and you accomplished a lot. You did wonderful things. But you did all of that in the wrong assignment. And so you get no credit for it. We can't take it with us. Something else we can't take with us is other faithful people. Look with me, if you will, in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 10. Very familiar passage says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one, emphasize that wording there, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. My point here is that all indications are that we will stand before God on judgment as an individual. We might prefer that God judged in a group basis, wouldn't we? If I could just stand before, if God would just make the O'Neill Church of Christ stand before judgment, maybe I could kind of shrink down and hide behind some of those good folks and God would let me usher me in that way. But Paul says, each one of us. Don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. But it's not enough to have found the right church. It's not enough to listen to a good preacher. It's not enough. It's important. It's not enough to associate yourselves with good godly brethren who are doing what's right and are living right and are standing by the principles of the Scriptures. That's important, but it's not enough, because God isn't going to say, "Oh, where did you go to church? Well, then come on in." You're going to stand before Him and give an account for what you have done. Let me use another illustration. My junior year of high school at West Point High School in Coleman, Alabama, Billy, Kevin, and I, in one football season, combined to score 38 touchdowns. Pretty impressive. For a high school football, especially the way we played, we didn't score a lot of touchdowns. We didn't have a big passing attack and all that. But Billy, Kevin, and I combined to score 38 touchdowns in one 10-game season. Billy scored 24. Kevin scored 14. I didn't score any. But it sounded better the first way I said it, didn't it? Billy, Kevin, and I combined, you add those three, you add 24 and 14 and zero, you still get 38. We want to be judged that way, don't we? But it doesn't work that way. Think about how many times the New Testament talks about Christian deception. Be not deceived. We can deceive ourselves into thinking, well, I go to a good church. We stand for the truth. We speak where the Bible speaks and is silent where it is silent. Our preacher preaches it right down the line, and if he doesn't, we'd run him out of here and bring somebody else in here who would preach the truth and nothing but the truth. And again, that's good. But what am I doing about it in my own personal life? Something else you can't take with you. That's your earthly body. We won't turn over there, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 37, the apostle uses the illustration of planting a seed, and he says that seed that's planted is not the same thing that's going to grow up. And he says that of our earthly bodies. That our earthly bodies, like a seed, will be planted in the ground, and something else on the resurrection day will be raised up. But it's going to be a different body. He says it's a spiritual body. And you know, that's a good thing, isn't it? It's a good thing that we won't be able to take our old, broken down, decaying, flawed bodies with us. And again, don't misunderstand what I'm about to say, but I'm not trying to diminish anybody's pain. But there's something beautiful in the midst of pain sometimes when an old, aged Christian who's lived faithfully, served and loved the Lord, is so racked with pain and disease, and they lay there on that hospital bed or that nursing home bed, and they just say, "I'm ready to go." There's something beautiful about that, isn't there? That sometimes it takes the pain to shock us into memory and into realization that this isn't all there is. There's something else. Something else you can't take with you is faith and hope. Faith, the Hebrew writer says, is evidence of things not seen. Paul says we walk by faith, not by sight. In heaven, we'll be walking by sight, not by faith. That's a good thing. Hope, Paul says, hope that's realized is not hope at all. But the title of the lesson isn't you can't take it with you. It's you can take it with you. Because despite that long list, and you could probably add to it, of things that you can't take with you, therefore they should not be of our greatest priority, some of them, there are some things you can take with you. We talked about faith and hope that will be replaced by sight. Paul says the greatest of these, faith, hope, and love, is love. Learn with me the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where the Apostle Paul, like many New Testament writers, groups those three in the beautiful triad of faith and hope and love. But he says, now abide, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 13, and now abide faith, hope, and love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. He would argue in this context that the reason that love is greater is because it endures. It will never end. And so then faith will be swallowed up in sight. Hope will be realized, and it's not hope anymore, it's realized. But love will continue. The greatest of these is love. And isn't it wonderful that you can take that with you? The love of God, the love of truth, the love of one another. And so that tells me something. If love endures, if love never ends, if love will last an eternity, then isn't that something I need to be focusing my life on? We have bought into a spiritual lie. The spiritual lie that says that over here is doctrine and over here is love, and those are opposed and you must choose one or the other. You can either be right down the line doctrinally or you can be open-hearted, loving, and warm, but you cannot be both. That is a lie from the devil. What the Scriptures teach us is that love is a doctrine. It's a teaching. It's a commandment of God. And we better be, not the only thing we better be about, but we better be about loving one another. Now, sometimes love is going to have to take the form of tough love, of admonishing and correcting someone, but it's always done in love. Because you can take love with you. Something else you can take with you, and this may be a frightening thought, is our deeds. Turn back with me to Revelation chapter 20. We heard in our Bible reading this morning about that judgment scene. And I don't know how literal or metaphorical some of this language is, but it teaches us something. Revelation 20, let's look just at verse 12. It says, I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which was the book of life. But then the last sentence says this, and the dead were judged according to their works, according to the things which were written in the book. If I understand that correctly, these books, plural, one of them may be the Word of God. Jesus says that's by which we'll be judged. One is certainly the book of life that contains the names of the faithful. But he seems to indicate that there's a book that has our deeds written in it. That's scary. That God has written down, if but metaphorically in His perfect wisdom and memory, that He's written down everything I've done. He's written down every word I've ever spoken. And not just the good and sweet things, but those hateful things that I said in anger. those colorful words that I said when I thought no one was listening. And in that book somewhere, there's a chapter simply entitled, Ken's Thoughts. Not just the things I've done, not just the things I've said, but my thoughts. And if it's not frightening enough to think that God says, I'm writing all this down, John says, those books will be open. And they'll be the basis of my judgment. I wish I didn't have to take it with me. But God says you do. Unless. We can also take with us the blood of Christ. Now, I've taken some liberty here. We don't really take this with us. It's already there. But we can affect upon the blood of Christ in our lives. Turn with me to the book of Hebrews, chapter 9. I want you to still keep in your mind that book that's there. There's a book for you. There's a book for me. And in that book is contained all of your deeds, all of your words, all of your thoughts. And they're going to be open. But remember this, Hebrews 9, verse 16 says, For where there is a testament, there must also of necessity be the death of a testator. For a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. Therefore, not even with the first covenant was dedicated without blood. For Moses had every precept to all the people according to the law was spoken. He took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book and all the people, saying, This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. Then likewise he sprinkled the blood, both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. According to the law, almost all things are purified with blood. And without shedding of blood, there was no remission. Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy place made with hands, which are just copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us, not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with the blood of another. He then would have to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once, at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. As it is appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. He will appear a second time apart from sin, from salvation. The only hope I have, the only hope that you have, is that we take the blood of Christ with us. So that when those books are open, those deeds, those words, and those thoughts that would damn us all to hell are somehow erased. The biblical term is blotted out, remitted, forgiven, washed away by the blood of the Lamb. Now, which would you take with you? If you could, would you take your money with you, your possessions, your earthly accomplishments? Or would you, like the Apostle Paul says, I counted those as garbage, that I might cling on to that which was greatest of importance in the blood of Christ. Let's close here. You can take your spiritual labor and sacrifice. Don't ever forget that the good things that you're doing in the kingdom, though they may not be appreciated by anybody else, the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, after speaking of that glorious resurrection and that new body, he says, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. What a juxtaposition from the words of Solomon, who said that all that I've accomplished in building this great kingdom was vanity. It's nothing. And now the words of the Apostle Paul on the other end of the spectrum says, your spiritual labor is not vanity. You see, you can take that with you. Can I add one more thing? You can take somebody else with you. Now, we said you can't bring this church with you and hide behind them on the day of judgment, but there's another sense in which you can bring somebody with you. Ever gone on vacation somewhere and it was just the best time you'd ever had? Maybe it was the scenery. It was just so beautiful. And you took pictures, but you knew the pictures weren't going to do it justice. Maybe it was just a place of entertainment, something you could see and do, and the shows and the roller coasters were just so wonderful. Whatever it is, you went and you just said, man, that was the best place ever. And you come home and immediately you want to go back. But you're not the selfish type. You want to go back and you say, y'all ought to go with us next time. We had the best time. The wonderful thing about heaven, one of the wonderful things, there's many, is that you're sharing it with someone else does not in any way diminish the glory that you will experience. You might not have judged it by looking at me, but I like to eat. If I bought a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts, I might want to share them with you, except that if you ate one, then I'd only have 11. And if I shared it with two of you, then I'd only have 10. And so I might be unwilling to share them, because the more I share it, the less I have. That's not heaven. Sharing the glories of heaven will not in any way diminish your experience there. If anything, the Scriptures tell us it will be enhanced. What a wonderful thought that you can share it with somebody else and it doesn't in any way take away from what you're experiencing. So the next time somebody says, you know, you can't take it with you, you say, yes, I can. I can take the blood of Christ. I can take my spiritual labor and my sacrifice. And if you've got a few minutes and you want to sit down and study the Scriptures with me, I can take you with me too. You're going somewhere. Be honest. Where is it? Where would you be today if you stood in judgment with God, knowing what you can take and what you can't take with you? Where will you be? If you're not a Christian this morning, or if you're a Christian that's wandered away, then why not? Ask yourself this question. Where will I be and what will my answer be? If we can help you in any spiritual way, let it be known right now as together we stand.